Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I am joined today by Peter Kapsner. Peter is a professor of Christian ministries at Bethel and Northwestern. He's been teaching since 2002. He's also a church consultant on leadership and matters of relationship between church and culture. So he's really conversant on the kinds of things that we talk about all the time here on Connecting Faith. And I just thought it would be fun today to just have a conversation partner throughout the hour as we look at the headline news of the day and seek to bring the mind of Christ to bear. So, Peter, welcome to Connecting Faith.
It's so great to be here with you again here, Carmen.
All right. It's just so fun. One of the things we're trying to model here is, like, how do we take the headline news and as Christians, how do we just engage in the conversation? How do we till the soil sort of that the culture is providing us, maybe even that secular media is providing us? And how do we till that soil? And how do we then as Christians represent Jesus in ways that honor him in those conversations? So you and I are just going to talk today across a number of headlines and see what we can do in terms of modeling for our listeners, what it might look like for them to then turn this afternoon or this evening or tomorrow over the weekend and do the same thing. So let's lead off with this very, very provocative headline. Peter, it's televangelist tells people, the headline, actually, this particular one from the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post, I'll just read it directly. A televangelist wants his followers to pay for a $54 million private jet. It's his fourth plane. Now, Peter, you and I have heard about this story. My guess is that most everyone listening right now has heard something about it. My guess also is that a lot of Christians have heard this and rolled their eyes. How can we think about these things? And then as Christians, sort of how can we engage with people who are immediately going to push back and say that is just not, that can't possibly be what Jesus has in mind?
Yeah, it's, you know, Carmen, I don't have that many pet peeves in life. I can count sort of slow drivers in the left lane and why I end up with nacho cheese on my shirt all the time. I mean, those are the two sort of main things, but this would be a third. It really strikes a nerve, this prosperity gospel and sort of this belief that God is kind of this cosmic vending machine, that if we just put a quarter of faith into the vending machine in the right kind of way with the right kind of prayer and press AA, we'll get what we want. And so these televangelists are really peddlers of that kind of prosperity gospel and faith that really preys on people's, I think, their sense of lack, their sense of uncertainty in life. And so we can just model, right, giving millions of dollars to a plane, and then God will certainly bless us with prosperity. And I think it's a classic example when you look at church history of how the church and the culture begin to blend with one another or begin to mirror one another. And it's a sort of this fancy term called syncretism is when the culture and the church start looking the same way. And so in America, we're very much often pursuing prosperity. We believe that our happiness comes the more prosperous that we are. And that gets blended in with the gospel in this way where God's favor is really shown because we have the wealth and the health that we desire. And it just wreaks havoc on people's lives. I think of so many people that I know that have followed this version of the gospel, and maybe they're sick with cancer or they have some other profound need in their life, and they just pray and think, if I just have the right amount of faith and the right amount of money and the right amount of opportunity, then God will bless me in this way. And it really is a perversion of the invitation of the gospel in a different way to live. So it wreaks havoc on people's lives. And not only that, it turns off the rest of the culture who looks at this and thinks this is what Christianity is. It's people who are using Christianity to maybe line their own pockets with money and pray on the weak. And the whole thing is really disturbing.
So for those who don't know this story, there's a guy named Jesse Duplantis, and he actually lives in a 35,000 square foot mansion in a heavily guarded on a heavily guarded piece of land in the state of Louisiana. And what he's saying to his followers is that he's believing for this $54 million airplane. It's called a Falcon 7.
Right.
Because if Jesus were here today on the earth, you know, Jesus wouldn't be walking around, and Jesus wouldn't be taking the bus, and Jesus wouldn't be flying coach. Jesus would be flying around in his own private jet, and not just any private jet, because the guy already actually has a private jet, but that he would be flying around in this particular $54 million bird, because then he wouldn't have to stop for gas. And I guess when I compare that to, like, the Jesus that I know from the Bible, I'll just tell you, I mean, I just furrow my brow. I'm like, I don't even really quite know where this comes from, this idea that a person is able to say, Jesus told me something directly, which is what this man is claiming. He's claiming that God told him this directly. And that people would believe that, totally contrary to what we say we believe, which is that, you know, God continues to speak through what he has spoken, and what he has spoken is contained in the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments. So, I'm just curious, Peter, if you were in a conversation with somebody who was tempted to send some money to, you know, to an individual like this, you know, how do we help that individual sort of see the falseness of this narrative?
Yeah, part of that article, Carmen, that was written about this situation too, that this person wanting the airplane said that if Jesus was here today too, he would certainly not have ridden a donkey, and that is such an important part of, you know, the expectation of the people of Jerusalem in Jesus's day was that he was the conquering hero. He was the one who was going to regain the health and the power of the kingdoms of this world. And so Jesus sort of turned that whole thing over on its head when, instead of riding in some Roman chariot down in Jerusalem to establish an earthly kingdom, he rode on this lowly donkey to demonstrate that really life in the kingdom of God is one of surrender. It's one of humility. It's one of willing to sacrifice your own well-being for the sake of another. It's laying down your life for a friend. I mean, you wouldn't have to go far with someone, Carmen, in conversations and just open up almost any of the biblical books, Old and New Testament, that demonstrate that the ways of the kingdom is that you yield your life, that you give up, that you surrender, all of these passages. And by contrast, you can't find support for this idea that God really desires our best life now, that we really should try to squeeze all of what we can out of this life, whether it's health or wealth. So it wouldn't take many passages of scripture to deconstruct and to see the falsity of what the promise and the invitation here is in this whole airplane thing.
All right. So I know that there are probably some people listening who are saying, hey, I'd like to weigh in on that. I'd like to talk about that. Peter and I are actually going to take your calls in the fourth segment of today's show. So starting at 3/4 after the hour, so in just a half an hour from now, we're going to be taking your calls at 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. So I'm going to go ahead and warm you up to that idea, so that as you're listening and as there are things that you say to yourself, you know, I'd like to talk more about that, I'd like to ask a question about that or weigh in on that, we're going to be opening the phone lines here in just a few minutes. President Trump signed something called the Right to Try Bill yesterday, Peter. And
that is,
and so, you know, I think that the hope there is that people who have been diagnosed with something that is certainly going to kill them now have the, quote, right to try even some things that are not yet proven to work. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. And one of the quotes from the article that I found interesting was that the resistance to this idea of the right to try was along the lines of, well, we may bring harm to them if we're going to use some experimental drug or pharmaceutical agent to try to help them. We may actually bring harm. And my first thought was, well, if somebody is in a terminal situation, you know, would they not want to take the risk at that point? And this strikes home for me, Carmen. I'm sure it does for a lot of our listeners when we have people in our lives that have been struck with a devastating illness. I know there's someone real close to me in my own family right now that's walking through the last stages of a terminal brain cancer, and sort of being alongside of that, if there is any sense of hope or possibility, And yet there is rules and red tape and regulations that, you know, on one level, I understand you don't want the snake oil salesman out there just making promises that can't be fulfilled. And yet at the same time, some kind of compassionate use, some kind of availability of drugs that don't need to go through 7 to 10 years of the FDA to get approved would be, I think, compelling for a lot of people in a situation that maybe it helps provide an extra year or two or three or maybe 5 or 10 for their lives. And if nothing else, it allows there to be more understanding and education done about how it impacts them on behalf of then future people. And so, again, it hits a real personal chord, members of my family. I know when I was in my 30s, actually, I was falsely diagnosed, thankfully, but I was diagnosed for a period of time with Lou Gehrig's disease and had to live under that terminal diagnosis for about 6 months of my life. And I'll tell you what, at that point, with young children and thinking about my young family and having to start making preparations to leave them behind, I would have gladly been willing to try just about anything at that point. So, again, can we find some balance with this where there is some compassionate use opportunity that is available? And I think that's what President Trump has done here. While also, you know, obviously we don't want anybody just peddling their wares in this situation, but it seems like we're moving towards a better balance with this.
I also I thought to myself as a person who my dad didn't die of a terminal illness, but he died when he was only 43 and we were young.
Yeah.
And so when you make that reference, you know, I do think we want to say to people, we want to remind people, no matter how old you are, now's actually the time to think about how your family would be cared for if your life were to end quickly, suddenly, now at this point. I know that, you know, there's like these conversations that families don't really like to have, and they're conversations about finances, and they're conversations about, you know, how would we go on without this particular member of our family? I mean, around here at my house, it would be like, who's going to cook?
Right.
I mean, there would be some like really, yeah. And so I think those are honest conversations for Christian families to have. And I also think that talking about heaven is important. Like we love this life and it's such a gift and it's such a blessing, but we don't worship it. And
I think
we
recognize.
Yeah. And so I think that there are all kinds of parts of this conversation that that would be good for families to have. All right. Hey, we got to take a quick break. When we come back here to Connecting Faith, Peter Kapsner and I are going to continue our conversation about the headline news of the day. And then in the second half of the show, we're going to have you join us in the conversation. So you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, and we'll be right back. Summertime. Hey, friends. This is Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I wasn't sure that that was our comeback music, but apparently it is. So it is summertime, and we are having some summertime fun today here on Connecting Faith. I'm spending the whole hour in conversation with Peter Kapsner. Peter is a professor of Christian ministries at Bethel and Northwestern. He's been teaching there since 2002. Lots of the classes that he teaches, obviously they're involve young people because that's who's mostly in college, but he spends a lot of time talking with them about literally sexy issues like sexuality and marriage. And so he ends up participating in lots of weddings because he's engaged with so many young people. So a little bit later today, we're going to talk about marriage and marriage in our culture. But I also know, I happen to know that he's a big fan of golf. He loves golf.
Oh, Carmen, and this is summertime, right? Language. This is so exciting.
Yeah. Well, and one of the greatest places in the world to play golf is Hawaii.
It is.
And so that is my segue to the conversation about would you stay or would you go?
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is, and you love volcanoes. I have really hit a sweet spot here in terms of finding a story that we could talk about.
You really have.
So, yeah, so Hawaii, this Kilauea volcano continues to erupt. The lava continues to flow, and people have now been told if they don't leave, then they are literally going to be on their own. So I just want to have the conversation with you. Would you stay or would you go?
Well, discretion is the better part of valor, right? So there's part of me that really would want to stay. I mean, there's this idea of the lava moving at a couple yards per minute at times. I just want to be around it and experience it. There's something about sort of the awesome power of the earth erupting in this way that I would love to just be near and to see that take shape. It would be something completely out of any category I have. On the flip side, I know absolutely nothing about the outdoors. I'm an avid indoorsman, and so I have a suspicion that I wouldn't last very long, that if I was one of those people cut off from any kind of help, that it would be a bad deal. But, you know, kidding aside, there's the volcano and that power, getting back to that. There's a passage in Genesis right away in the beginning of creation where it says the earth was formless and void. And that phrase within the Hebrew of the Old Testament, the way it's been written, literally means that it was this unfolding chaos, that there was this awesome power that really needed to be reined in. And it could only be reined in a combination of God with his stewards, the male and the female, as they worked in creation together. And I think when you see just this awesome power and this chaos of the volcanoes, it's this stark reminder of, even though we think we can control the earth in so many ways through scientific research or through our own sense of intellect or whatever it is in whatever way we approach it, the world still is a lot of chaos and it's unfolding. And we really only in our tethering with God can we hope to sort of, you know, keep a rein on things on some level. It's really fascinating to watch.
You know what? It has been extraordinary to watch. I mean, I do think that we imagine we have a whole lot more control than we do,
right,
over so many things. Certainly the rising water yesterday throughout the southeastern United States was a reminder that we don't control that. And this is just, when this lava hits something, it just incinerates it immediately.
It,
I mean, it's incredible. It's literally reshaping the landscape. And it's nature sort of reclaiming much of what man has sought to build. And I've been very mindful watching this, of just the whole concept of how the earth is groaning in eager longing for,
yeah,
man's redemption. Like, we acknowledge that it's not just humanity that's going to be redeemed. It's all of creation. And this groaning, these like birth pangs that the earth goes through, and these convulsions of earthquakes and volcanoes and tsunamis and on and on and on. These are a part of the natural order after the fall.
Right.
And so I think that for Christians, there's all kinds of opportunities to have really meaningful conversations with folks about the dramatic power of nature, but then really ultimately, you know, whose hands is all of this in, and sort of how is God engaged or involved? Because I do think there would be people who would say, well, if God wanted to, God could stop the lava flow, which is completely and totally true. But God does allow the natural progression of things to take place because he has allowed us to live with the consequences of sin.
It's so true, Carmen. I mean, when you go back to that first and kind of fundamental sin of the Garden of Eden in Genesis 3, when the invitation of the serpent at that time was that you can be like God. In fact, you can cut God out of the equation. You can live out this life on your own, control the future on your own. You can make do with everything outside of God. And these natural, and I suppose natural after the fall disasters, are horrible on one level. And then they also serve as this reminder of the falsity of that promise of the serpent of Genesis 3, where we're standing at that tree of the knowledge of good and evil all day long, just like they were. And the question for us is, will we cut God out of the equation in our life, or will we bow and bend our knee and follow? And I do think there is something about the disasters of this world that are as painful and filled with suffering as they are, and embedded within them is an invitation to remember a couple of things. One, we are not in control of our future in the way that we think, number one. And number two, that this world is not functioning in the way that it is ultimately going to function, that there is a restoration coming. There is a reconciliation of all things that is coming. And Jesus was very clear with his followers in the book of Matthew, and he said, you know, there's going to be war and famine and disease and disaster and all of these things. They will always be there. And when you see those things then speed up as if they are the birth pangs before our birth, that's when to pay real careful attention that the end is near. And I'm not in any way saying that the end is near, because most generations tend to think that the end is near. Things have never been as bad as they are now, we tend to think. But what Jesus was pointing out was the idea that this world isn't functioning as it should, and it will and needs to be redeemed.
Hmm. So, Peter, let's see if we can have this this marriage conversation before we go to the break. I don't
Love
know
it.
That we'll get it all in. We
sure.
may come back after and continue it. The pace of change in our culture related to the subject of marriage, you know, we could talk about, if we wanted to have a show that every day we talked about the headlines related to marriage and the changing understanding of marriage in our culture and strange expressions and all of that. I mean, we could literally do the show on that every single day because there is a marriage headline every day in our culture. Last week we would have done the royal wedding as probably our theme for the week.
Right.
But right now, in terms of like what's in the news related to this, there's a guy named Gavin Newsom. Now, some folks may recognize his name as the mayor of San Francisco. Others may recognize his name as a person who is, you know, he's now making a bid for a bigger office. So do you remember when Gavin Newsom in 2004 really, I think, what he thought would be a one-off act of civil disobedience, as the mayor of San Francisco said, you know, he was going to sign marriage licenses for gay people, and it turned into a 29-day saga during which 4,000 people were actually illegally wed.
Yeah.
And at that point in time, in 2004, both the Democrats and the Republicans were all, you know, everybody in one chorus and one voice was basically saying, you know, what you're doing is wrong. And yet now they're using that in his campaign ads. And I just think that just shows us how far we've come in a very short period of time.
Yeah, Carmen. I mean, those are some of the early seeds that have now been brought fully to harvest that we saw. I think about with those events that you mentioned in San Francisco, I think about movies like Philadelphia with Denzel Washington and Tom Hanks and how, you know, they were these sort of outliers in our culture at that time. But they began to sow the seeds that now have germinated and sort of come to fullness now a decade or two later. And it was never more apparent than in the class on sexuality that I've taught here at Northwestern for the better part of 5 years, and then a gender class that I've taught at Bethel in the years before that. And I remember it was probably about 2010 that I would always do question and answer with the students. And when they asked their questions, the questions tended to be around things like cohabitation before marriage, maybe pornography, premarital sexuality. Those were sort of the main three categories of questions. But nobody was asking a single question about same gender marriage or same gender relationships or anything. And I came back, I think it was 2011, and all of a sudden, the class was exploding with that question. That was the only question that was being asked. And this is the same time then that some of these outliers that were happening in San Francisco and maybe in the Hollywood industry began to be more full-blooded because of the marriage amendment conversation in our country started taking full shape. And that's when these seeds that had been in the soil for a while in various ways really were brought forth to harvest around that marriage amendment. And now they just blossom all day long. Where this redefinition, my students to this day are just terribly confused and troubled and don't understand what the right pathway forward is. And even at this point have sort of given up wanting to have conversation about it anymore because it's just too confusing. So it's just sort of live and let live kind of idea.
Okay, so we've got like, I don't know, 30 seconds before we have to go to the
sure.
break. So I'll just set this question up and then we can talk about it afterwards. So we had some surprise guests last night at dinner. Two couples showed up at our house, and we knew like 15 minutes beforehand that they were coming. One of them, young couple, they're engaged. They have a nearly 4-year-old son. And so part of our conversation at dinner was, you know, when are you guys getting married? They've been engaged for like 5 years. Mm. They don't see any actual reason to get married. And so I want to talk about that when we come back.
Yeah, great.
Friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. My conversation partner today is Peter Kapsner. I'm Carmen LeBurge. We'll be right back. Hey, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LeBurge. Joining me today is Peter Kapsner. Let's see. What'll I add to the things that I've shared with people? He's got a PhD from Edinburgh, which is why he is so quick to be able to come up with all kinds of wonderful answers to the questions that, that I pose to him. But what we're trying to demonstrate today is what does it just sort of look like to range about in conversation about the headlines of the day? What does it look like to bring the mind of Christ to bear? What does it look like to till the cultural soil together? In order that, you know, we might root out some things that, need to be, you know, hauled to the edge, but that we also might plant some seeds and we might actually encourage fruitful growth, not only in one another and mutually edifying conversation, but that as we go forth from this conversation into the world that God so loves, that we might actually do so as genuine ambassadors of kingdom principles. So that's what we're trying to do here. So Peter, welcome again to Connecting Faith. Thanks for this conversation today.
Yeah, it's great. Great to be with you, Carmen.
So before the break, I sort of teed up a question, and it grew out of a conversation that I had at my dinner table last night. I'm not sure that I know I didn't seal the deal. I just didn't feel like I quite knew where to go with this particular young person. She and her fiancé have been engaged for about 5 years. They have a nearly four-year-old son. I would describe them as happily married if they were married. But they're not married. They own a house together. They share a bank account. They are living as if they are married, but they're not married. And so I asked at one point, it was just the women at the table at that point. The men had gone off to do something else. And, you know, and I just said to her, so, you know, are there actual plans? And she's like, well, what do you mean? And I'm like, well, you guys have been engaged a long time. Are there actually plans to get married? And she said, no. And she does not, she just honestly, Peter, she just doesn't see any reason to get married. She views that as like expensive and disruptive at this point to, you know, to the life that they're living. So how, as a person who engages in these conversations all the time with young people, how might you have approached that?
Yeah, that's one of the hardest ones, Carmen, because rarely in those moments can you just sort of have this silver bullet thing to say that's just going to, you know, completely speak into the situation. And I think to recognize that it's not just happening for the millennial generation that would be non-Christian, but it's happening in the next generation in my classes that is Christian, that the same questions are applying more and more about why even bother to get married. We've sort of seen now the destructive reality of divorce kind of over two generations now in our culture. And so people are asking the question, why bother with that? If we just love each other, let's just sort of hang out together kind of idea. And so I don't know what you can really introduce in a given moment in a conversation. I think there's more of a cultural turn that needs to take shape in the church where we need to talk about the covenant of marriage in some ways that historically understood the covenant of marriage. It would include love between two people, but it wasn't reduced down to those things. The idea of the covenant was that two people for a lifetime would turn their faces outward together and to tend to God's world together in a variety of ways, and that they were stronger together in that than they would have otherwise been alone, and that the covenant was an outward-looking one with a purpose and a design. And frankly, Carmen, I think there's going to need to be several years of that modeled from our church as opposed to the idea of, I found somebody, I fell in love, they're going to love me for a lifetime, I'm going to love them for a lifetime, and off we go. That obviously hasn't proven out that way. So I think you have that at one level where the church has some work to do on reestablishing a model for marriage that is far more kingdom-oriented. I think in the moment, if there is an opening, it can be that idea, well, what is going to hold you together if how you feel about one another is maybe it kind of ebbs and flows throughout the course of a lifetime? Because I think anybody who's been married, and I've been married for 24 years, both Hallie and I are deeply committed to one another, but it's those vows of marriage that we said that sort of holds us together in those times when marriage does get tough and it does get difficult. And if you have those around you and surrounding you, they can hold you together at that time. And so you might want to ask a younger couple, so what holds you together if things are going to get difficult, if and when you hit those inevitable, really difficult parts of your relationship? What do you see holding you together? But you may not get that opening. That's the only one I know of, however, that can at least spring forth some further conversation.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. That's a really good observation. Okay, so one of the things that you talk about a lot with students, sort of the identity politics of this generation,
yep.
Specifically the issue of transgenderism.
And so I thought that in part to sort of educate our listenership about what's happening across the country in terms of law related to transgenderism and transgender rights, I would lift up these this headline from PBS. It is also covered by NPR. And so these are stories that the national news is covering. First of all, I find it interesting that the national news is covering some of these very what would be considered in other ways very local stories. But obviously they know there's a thread here that they want to pull. So on May 22nd, a federal judge in Virginia ruled in favor of Gavin Grimm, an 18-year-old transgender, I'm going to say person, who while in school sued the district for the right to use the boys' bathroom. So obviously, you know, Gavin is biologically a girl and wants to use the boys' bathroom. Gavin's case began in 2014. And again, it's hard for me to use all of these male pronouns as this article is written because I actually don't want to legitimate what's going on here. And so Peter, part of my challenge is how do I even read the way this is being reported because the pronouns being used and the descriptions of this individual are contrary to what I know to be true about this person's biological reality. So I think that even just reading it is hard. Well, here's the outcome. On May the 22nd, a federal judge in Virginia ruled in this individual's favor in relationship to bathrooms that that Gavin is going to be allowed to use. We also have this Boyerton, Dallas, I guess this is an Oregon case. There's a Boyerton case and a Dallas, Oregon case as well. And so these transgender students or these and non-transgender students and their parents are really in very heated local debate because non-transgender students and their parents don't really want boys in the girls' bathroom and they don't want girls in the boys' bathroom. And Peter, as a dad of four, I guess I would just sort of open up the question and say, you know, where does this conversation end? And like, I think about, I'm sending my kids off to camp this summer. Do I need to have a conversation with the camp about their bathroom use policies and about whether or not there's going to be girls in the boys' dorms?
Yeah, Carmen, I mean, this is such a multi-layered conversation. And I think to begin with, we have to start talking about it. And we have to talk about it at a very early age, unfortunately, on some levels with our kids. Or we need to just keep them out of the mainstream mix these days. I know a person in my life that's a middle school counselor, and she had been away from middle school counseling for about 5 years and came back. And she said, the single biggest change I've experienced in these 5 years away and then in coming back is that we're finding that the school has to help young people identify what their gender is by the time that they're 7, 8, or 9. And they're even beginning to explore these concepts at 5 or 6 in the classroom. And so I think it goes even beyond the idea of what the camp policy is. I mean, it's becoming more and more pervasive, the questions in our culture, and even introducing ideas of what your gender identity might be at a very early age. And so we really only have two options, I think, as Christian parents and Christian people. Is one is we've got to get our head around this and begin to talk about it at an early age, or we just need to keep our kids away from it. You know, they're so young and so impressionable. And it's really those two options at this point with that. And I think the other piece then in our education is that we have to get ourselves out of the mainstream conversation and really do our work and our research and begin to understand what's at stake here and what's at play. Because if you actually do the research, and you would think that just based on media, that really what people need to do is they need to align their sense of gender with their biological sex. And so the way they do that best is they know for sure what gender they are from sort of a psychological standpoint, so the thinking goes. And therefore, if there's a misalignment between my sense of gender and my biological sex, I can bring that into alignment by changing my biological sex, thus, you know, turning male into female or female into male through a conversion surgery. And yet what the research is showing, and some of the most recent research, I know the leading gender reassignment surgeon in the world has recently stopped practicing gender reassignment surgery altogether because they said it's absolutely abusing our young people. They are not being helped by this idea. It does not bring a sense of stability into their life when they feel like maybe their gender is lined up with their biological sex. It's not bringing healing or hope or wholeness. And this person is not even a believer. and saying, I will not practice this anymore. I know a very liberal, in fact, lesbian feminist scholar on the East Coast is saying things like it's child abuse, what we're doing to our kids with all of this gender reassignment conversation. And she was saying that this tends to come at a time in a culture's existence when that culture begins to unravel. And she was pointing to the Greek Empire and to the Roman Empire and to sometimes in the German Empire, where they think they're becoming so much more sophisticated and enlightened and more aware. And yet it's often a culture that doesn't believe in itself anymore when they begin to blur these gender lines, and it leads to the unraveling of the culture. And so we've got to educate ourselves about what's going on and what the real answers are. And then we either need to protect our kids from this, or we need to get into conversation with them about it.
Yes, I like the balance there between, you know, protecting them from everything that we can protect them from, but then also preparing them for the realities of the world in which they're going to have to navigate.
Absolutely.
And so I think that's really true. I know that I remember having a conversation with Andrew Walker. He wrote an excellent book on this subject. I think it's like Transgenderism in the Church. It doesn't have like necessarily, you know, a title that's going to grab you. But what he talks about in there and in his conversation, we spend a lot of time actually talking about, so if you have a child who, you know, they've got a friend, let's call the friend Billy, you know, and they've grown up with Billy as a boy.
Right.
And Billy now is identifying as a girl. Well, when Billy comes to our house, we still call Billy Billy. And we still, you know, we're still treating Billy as, you know, as a child of God and a human being. We're also praying for Billy. We're recognizing that he's deeply confused. But we're going to keep treating Billy as if Billy is Billy. And, you know, in much the same way that if one of our friends showed up, you know, wearing a somewhat wacky costume instead of regular clothes, if Billy shows up wearing something that is more appropriate for a girl than a boy, you know, we're just going to sort of at this age and stage just recognize that, you know, Billy's kind of in a costume. And I think that, you know, if we can get to the place where we can at least help our kids not totally reject those other children, because we want to remain in their lives in such a way,
right,
that we're there and we're present and we're demonstrating love. But we can't allow the confusion to, I don't know, sort of rob our own children of their sense of identity as children of God. And I think that is the big challenge. We don't want to send our children as sheep among wolves, because we know that's, I mean, and yet that's the reality of discipleship. And so I do think it's an incredibly difficult tension.
It is. To hold that tension that you described is that, you know, when Jesus came, it said that he was filled with grace and truth all at the same time. And how do you hold that tension where that you don't have a patronizing love and compassion? You actually have a love and compassion for people. And Jesus clearly did. The only people that Jesus ever was standoffish to or really got angry towards were those religious leaders who were keeping the people out of the kingdom that desperately needed to get in. And for everybody else, whatever they were struggling with and whatever they were dealing with, his table was open. It was a table of fellowship and healing and wholeness. And so while we need to, I think, deconstruct the way so much of our media and our culture is talking about these things, and I think go at those things pretty hard, because they do need to be deconstructed, we can never lose sight that the pervasive way in which we are to be as people is to be as people of love and compassion, and that people can sense that about us. Because the reality is we don't know how somebody's story is going to turn out at the end of the day. And so to just reject with harsh words or to come up against, we need to stand alongside and walk with and live in that tension the very best we can.
I love it. All right, friends, maybe you're listening and you're saying to yourself, I'd like to get in on that conversation. Well, right after the break, we are going to open the phone lines so you can start calling us now at 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Maybe you want to talk with us about something we have talked about thus far. Maybe you want to talk about MS-13 or Roseanne or Starbucks or tariffs, whatever. Peter and I are open to a conversation about anything. So join us right back here on Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. I'm joined by Peter Kapsner. We got to take one more quick break, and then we'll be back taking your calls. I got an old church choir Hey, friends, this is Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaVerge. I'm joined today in conversation by Peter Kapsner. And during this segment, we're taking your calls. The number here is 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. We had a caller, Frank, from St. Paul. Frank, thank you for your call. I know you're not still on the line. Frank called to basically school Peter and I on something that we totally should have said in the first segment when we were talking about the Jesse DePlantis story in relationship to believing that God was going to send him $54 million so he could buy a Falcon 7 jet. Frank from St. Paul said, hey, when Jesus comes back, he won't need a jet plane. He's going to be much quicker and more powerful. He won't need one. So, amen, Frank. You are totally right. Now, Guy from Goodrich, North Dakota, is on the line. Guy, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thank you, Carmen. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for bringing up this topic. I believe it is a serious issue that affects the credibility of the Christian church. I totally do not support Jesse DePlantis. I think his whole approach to ministry is really obscene and hurtful to Christianity as a whole. However, I have been a student of the quote-unquote Word of Faith movement, which Jesse would probably claim to be a part of. I was raised a Lutheran, but having suffered from chronic pain many years, back pain, I did start looking into the Word of Faith. A lot of it I find I don't agree with, but yet there's one preacher who kind of started the whole thing. His name is Kenneth E. Hagin, H-A-G-I-N, and his teachings are very much in line with biblical teaching, and I think are very much beneficial to those who want to grow their faith, which is certainly possible for all of us. And I would recommend checking out Kenneth E. Hagin on YouTube.
Hey, Guy, thank you so much for your call. Peter, one of the things that Guy really like reminds me, and so I'm so appreciative that he called and shared this. We don't want to in any way suggest that God is not in the business of answering prayers, working miracles, pouring out his blessings in ever more abundant measure into people's lives. So Peter, when we talk about, you know, the ways in which God does miraculously answer prayer, does heal us, does restore us. I think that the challenge that we face when we look at like the prosperity gospel is that we're not claiming that as something that God owes us or that God must do. But they are things that God still does in people's lives.
Yeah, it is a really good corrective, because you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater on this one. God really does heal, and there's stories all over the world of that happening all the time. I think one of my favorite tension stories from the biblical text on this is the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego before they were just about ready to get chucked into the fiery furnace. And what do they say? They say, our God can deliver us. There is absolutely no doubt in their lives that God could. And then they said these profound words, but even if he doesn't, yet we still will serve him. And so they had this belief that God absolutely could. And yet if he didn't, they still would serve. And that's, you know, it's one of the great promises of the Christian life, that regardless of what comes in our lives, there's always hope and always future. If the empty tomb teaches us nothing else, it teaches us that no matter where you go and what happens in life, there's always hope and future, regardless of what comes. So to hold that tension of we can be healed, but even if we're not, yet we still will follow. That's I think, the invitation in this.
So I do, I do think that anytime we're having a conversation about different varieties of faith expression and different ways that some of our listeners might be engaged in or accessing different ministries and listening to different varieties of preachers and finding, in some places, fruit that is moving them forward in their own Christian walk. I also think that, one of the things that Guy points out is just because there was one person who was teaching on this that was, you know, in his view, worth listening to, there are lots of charlatans who are then on that bandwagon, because that bandwagon is producing a lot of wealth for a lot of people who are teaching things and who are capitalizing, frankly, on the pain that people find themselves in, and people are looking for a way out of that pain and willing to pay their way out if they think that will get them some kind of blessing from God. And so, friends, I hope that you hear us trying to strike a genuine, faithful balance. We want people to go to the scriptures of the Old and New Testaments to hear God speak through what he has already spoken. And so from that viewpoint, I think we need to recognize that when God chooses to act in the context of human history, even miraculously so today, he's doing so, you know, of his own volition, and he is doing so in ways that are always in accordance with what he has already revealed about himself, because God is going to be faithful to be God, in and out of season and in every context. So again, Guy, thank you for that phone call. Okay, we have Sierra in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Sierra, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello.
Hello.
We have an interesting situation.
Okay, share with us.
I am, as lifelong teacher and instructor and special needs parent support person, we have come to Sioux Falls since our home was flooded in Minot in 2011. And I have the music garden classes for parents and family children in my home and at some of the nursing homes around. I have been asked if I would open a studio at one of the churches in town, which has a marvelous location and lots of little kids. The situation is, though, that this particular congregation, and I think its whole body, ordains practicing homosexuals. And
I know where you're going. I know where you're going. You're feeling a tension.
You're destroying me.
Yeah, you're feeling a tension. So Peter, let's speak into Sierra's situation here. Sierra, I'm willing to bet that there is both an opportunity to bear positive witness and to engage in what God has clearly gifted you to do. And to use the gifts, talents, and abilities that he has given you in an environment where the current organizational structure is doing something that is contrary to your conscience. Is that, do I about have it?
You did a good job.
Okay. So, Peter, let's speak into Sierra's challenge here. You know, there's an organizational body that is that's engaged in a practice that she does not personally believe or condone, and yet that facility is open to being a ministry center in which she can use her gifts. So, what do you think?
Yeah, thank you for that. It's a great question. It's a very complicated question. I think it resists a single answer, but. A couple of quick thoughts on that is, you know, there is a difference between a congregation that's trying to walk this out together, where there's members of the congregation that maybe are in a gay or lesbian lifestyle or marriage or relationship, and figuring out how as a body to walk that kind of out and hold the tension there. It is a different question when it comes to leadership, and I don't think we can shy away from that or just sort of bracket that off or eliminate that, because the leadership really is going to set the tone of any kind of organization. And specifically in the church, I mean, again, I go back to Jesus's primary concern when he was teaching and ministering in this world was what was being said relative to the religious leaders of the day. And the religious leaders were propagating a sense of the kingdom that simply wasn't true. And so I do think we have to have a different standard of conversation when it comes to leadership in the churches relative to what is being advocated for or condoned versus living in the tension of our congregation, figuring these things out together and the tension of that. They're two different conversations.
Hey, Sierra, can we pray for you before you hang up?
That'd be great.
All right, Father, we thank you so much for the gifts, talents, abilities, and opportunity that you have given to Sierra. And we ask for your perfect discernment in this opportunity that's set before her as she seeks to be a faithful witness to who you are and seeks to edify others through the gifts that you've given her. Father, we ask that either you would provide a location for doing this where this internal conscience conflict does not exist, or that you would help her to be a positive, faithful witness in that environment. And in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, Peter, you and I are about out of time in our conversation today. It sure has been fun. Friends, we have loved having you with us here today on Connecting Faith for this sort of wide-ranging conversation with Peter Kapsner, Professor of Christian Ministries at Bethel and Northwestern. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Carmen LaBerge. Hey, Peter, if people want to get in touch with you, what's your best social media follow?
Yeah, you know, I've got a Twitter account under Dr. Peter Kapsner is where to go at this point. It is private because my students don't always know the boundaries with professors these days, but go ahead and give it a shout and I can accept the followers there.
Love it. All right, friends. Otherwise, you can visit us online at myfaithradio.com. Connecting Faith has its own page. You can always email me, Carmen at myfaithradio.com. Have a great night and God bless.
Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.